702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DSTV channel 856.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, igniting economic collaboration through trust at the 2022 World Economic Forum. That's African Astity. Absa is a registered FSP. Well, coming up on the program tonight, Bruce is in Davos, where he's been speaking to former Eskom head Brian Dames and also CNN's Richard Quest. What we'll be doing is playing out some of those interviews this evening that he's had, and interesting discussions, especially around power. Also other discussions today as well. It's been the last day of proceedings at the WEF in Davos, including the topic of Ukraine. And that's the big one. Many business leaders getting together and saying we have to do something about the consequences of the war in Ukraine. And we've heard about wheat problems and the fact that Africa's not getting enough wheat. And commodity prices as well have been shooting up, but food prices as well shooting up, which is not good for us. Great for the miners' commodity prices, but the food prices, not good for us whatsoever. So taking a look at some of that shortly. And then continuing to talk business as we emerge from the COVID-19 pandemic, Life Healthcare will have their results, and in the personal finance feature with Warren Ingram of Galileo Capital, we'll tell you not to panic if the markets collapse. And the markets could still collapse, although today the oil share is shooting up about 2.8%, which is good for us. And we think, you know, this is good. But, you know, it's also recovering from what happened this last week. We've lost quite a bit lately. So, but it's good news if you have your investments and you bought low and then maybe you're selling a high today, perhaps you'll make some money. All this and more coming up in the next 2 hours of The Money Show. I'd like to hear from you, though. You can leave a WhatsApp note on 072-702-1702. Or perhaps you just want to SMS. You can, you know. You can send them on 31702 or 31567.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, Bruce is in Davos, Switzerland, where the World Economic Forum has been wrapping up. Interest rates, the war in Ukraine, the global economy. These are just some of the topics under discussion. And it's been a very important time in Davos, Switzerland. And let me tell you why. And this is because for the first time since before COVID started, businessmen delegates, businesswomen, everyone's been getting together to talk about the global problems. And these are interest rates. And we've seen it with what's been happening in our country. We've had to hike the interest rate by 50 basis points. And that's not the end. It's going to get a lot worse than that. We're going to have more than just 50 basis points, at least one percentage point coming within this year. And this is the big problem. So this is all coming out of the global economy. It's not just us. We're tracking what's happening in the United States. We're looking at what's happening in Europe as well. And then this war in Ukraine. These are just some of the topics under discussion. And we hope that they're going to come up with some concrete resolutions, which we have to see. We'd like to see come out of Davos. But for us, it's been something else as well. And just listening to Bruce this week, it's been good to hear how South Africa has been accepted. In fact, somebody spoke about a safe haven destination. Look, we do have our corruption. And I've looked at the SMS line and the WhatsApps coming in saying, oh, come on, Ray, but what about what's happening here with corruption, et cetera, et cetera. But we're still seen as that. We can get rid of that corruption. We can wipe the slate clean, so to speak, and restore that confidence. Well, that means investment. That means that people will be putting money into our country. Look at what happened with S&P Global. They also changed their whole outlook for our country from stable to positive. So that's a little bit of a green shoot there. Well, Bruce, earlier on today, he spoke to the former head of Eskom, Brian Dames. Now, you remember who Brian Dames is. He was there before all this rot set in, before all the state capture set in. And he's trying to stabilize, he's trying to develop. Anyway, Bruce chatted to him today, talking about the way forward for our country.
We have to get our current fleet of coal plants to work. We need to decommission what is old to save water, more importantly, in South Africa. And actually, it will give you a better sense of how to handle with the energy security issues. We have to invest in expansion of our grids. So without the expanding of our grids in South Africa or in the whole of Southern Africa, we will not be able to get to a cleaner, greener future.
We've got an energy minister very keen on nuclear as part of the solution. You're suggesting that it's not or shouldn't be?
No, nuclear for South Africa has made a lot of sense. The capital cost for us is just unbearable. Yeah. We cannot afford it. There are better, cheaper alternatives. I do believe that things such as hydrogen, or for that matter, long-duration energy storage, where we invest significant amounts of, does provide a solution. I also believe that if you can interconnect more of Southern Africa, and you unleash the gas, and you unleash some of the hydro, and build an integrated network in Southern Africa, you can, to a great extent, deal with the energy needs.
And that's 10, 15 years hence. 10, 15 months hence, do we have a solution?
10, 15 months hence, the only thing that we can build in 10, 15 months is solar, or 18 months, a wind farm, provided we start today. Now, we have doing 200 megawatts now for the mining industry.
Yep.
That's significant. We have, you know, 2,000 megawatts of pipeline capacity that we're going to close over the next year. But again, it needs access to the grid. It needs a whole lot of things to happen. We have seen movement, so there's been great support to have.
Is the policy and the legislation sufficient to get this moving now? Or do we still have hurdles?
We have seen the movement of the 100 megawatts.
Yeah.
We've seen the regulator deal with that. We, our first 200 megawatt projects has just gone through this week. We've announced that.
Good.
That is closing in July. That's
going to
be
when
important.
Do we get building, and when can we flick a light on and say,
we
that
start
comes
building
from a solar
panel? The 1st of August.
Brilliant.
Okay, so that is for a mining company. But we have to do a lot more of that.
Sure.
But the issue that we're talking about is not unique to South Africa, particularly the issue around building grids. Building grids requires land and requires permitting of land, expropriation for servitudes. In Europe, it takes 10 years. In South Africa, it also takes 10 years. That time we have to reduce, because without that, and that's not an Eskom issue, it's something where all of us left together, the private landowners, the IPPs that own the land, Eskom that owns some of the land.
It's a state of emergency, though, isn't it?
It is, and needs to be done. The first thing we should do is make sure what we have works.
Exactly.
Usually important. So, you know, and we have enough.
Yeah.
The first capacity we can all find is the capacity we have.
And so Eskom is fixable in your view?
Yeah. You have to.
We have to.
You have to. You have to bring the skills, and all of us will have to help. And there's people that have done it, can do it, and they're all South African.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure they're prepared to do it.
Mamoloko Kubai, who's leading the delegation here, said we must bring people back. But I recall Tito Boweni saying that 2 years ago here at Davos as well. It's urgent.
Yeah, people leave no company. They believe people.
Yeah.
They work for people. So who you bring back and who you ask. So I was asked the same question years ago.
Yeah.
Give me a list of names. I've given the list. So they're all over the world. They're doing exactly what they've done in South Africa and other parts of the world.
There we go. That was Brian Dahmer speaking to our very own Bruce Whitfield. And it's quite encouraging to hear that. And I was just sitting here thinking to myself, that's good. We have the skills. We've got the people. We need to put Eskom together. I think the big question is, though, are we going to go totally from coal? Are we going to go into renewable energy? Are we going to get away from coal? But in saying that, what happens to those who have invested in coal? And of course, our unions as well are going to say, you know, Ray, what about jobs? We have jobs that are invested in there as well. So there has to be this whole transfer from coal into renewable energy. But we have to do this now because the load shedding just continues and it's getting worse and worse and worse. So there we go. Brian Davis, he used to head up Eskom, saying there are the solutions here. We can do this and this is how you should be doing it. So I'm hoping the government is listening to The Money Show tonight. Then, of course, Richard Quest. Now, Bruce, if he goes to Davos, I can promise you he will meet up with Richard Quest, because the two of them together is quite a sight to watch, actually. The ideas just pop out. And the big thing about talking to Richard Quest is that he reflects how other countries, how the United States, others see South Africa. Let's take a listen to that conversation.
Good. It's been excellent. It's been first rate. It's been one of the best Davoses I've ever been at. And I guarantee you they will not be able to repeat it, because the reasons it's been so good are the reasons they won't repeat it. There are fewer people here.
Yes.
And you feel it.
Yes.
The promenade is not an orgy of biotech, crypto, hedge funds, every bank, financial institution you can think of holding a party or a storefront. There is crypto and there's blockchain, but they're there to talk about that.
Yes.
And they're the real issues. So you've got fewer people, you've got less nonsense. And those people who have come here because there are serious issues to be discussed.
And more serious issues, probably, than anything since the global financial crisis.
Oh, no, no, more than that. More than that. No, this is way beyond that, because this has got war involved. This has got war, and this has the potential for, you know, conflagration of a much greater scale. And so I found that my discussions, my private discussions, my interviews, everybody's been much more engaged than in the past.
Previously, people worried about petty, silly things. And now you've got the whammy, the war and the destabilization, what that does to global food security. And plus, on top of that, the chaos that has been caused by COVID and lockdowns around the world and trade barriers and trade restrictions all over the world as well and constraints around the world. This is tight.
They are the practical results.
Yeah.
But allow me to give you the philosophical or the policy point that all those exhibit. They exhibit a failure in everything we've believed in for the last 50, 60 years. And to some extent, a failure of not WEF per se, but WEF's concept, construct, dialogue.
Yes.
Collaboration. I can hear Klaus saying it. Dialogue, collaboration. Bring these new countries into the tent. Russia and China, multilateral. It's gone right out the window. First of all, you've got a war in Europe. This country that's at war, by the way, Russia, for the last 20 years, they have been feted, groveled to, genuflected at up there. Sberbank, VTB, all the big players. They're not here because they weren't invited now, obviously. Yeah. But China, multilateralism. Well, hang on, we'll just close down and we'll just export our supply chain issues to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So people come here with a great sense of, it's like being told the world's flat.
It is. But there's also the wonderful thing about this Davos is it is at a critical tipping point in the next three decades. It's redefining. This is the building block, perhaps, of the next three decades.
Well, I'll disagree with you.
Please.
It can't be the building block because we don't know what to build. You know, until the war ends, until China reopens, until there is an element of renegotiation or at least engagement, we don't know where it's going. And Bruce, we have, if all this wasn't bad enough, we have inflation at 40-year highs.
Yep.
I'm old enough to remember.
You remember the 1970s?
Of course I do. And I remember the 80s and Volcker squeezing inflation out of the system. And the policy mistakes that have been made that have allowed this inflation, some of which are understandable, some of which are not. Some of them are acceptable, some of them are reckless. But my point is, there's one common thread to every interview I've done when I've asked the question, and they've all said this is the most difficult time they can remember.
Well, there you have it. The most difficult time they can remember. And the world has gone through so much. It's gone through so much in the past couple of months. And it's the interesting thing because we went from COVID-19 and, you know, the beginning of 2020. And we thought to ourselves, sure, this pandemic is something. When we get to the end of it, we'll be able to rebuild our local economies. We'll be able to rebuild all sorts of things. We have a look at the repo rate. I mean, think about that. 400 basis points at the start of 2020. And those with bonds and who owe a lot of money were rejoicing, saying, oh, thank goodness for this. Thank goodness for this. Well, now we've come through this COVID-19 where people lost their jobs. They lost everything, basically, because they couldn't work. So that little bit of respite that came with those 400 basis points was great. But you had to get to the fact that you could lose your job. And there were retrenchments. And we saw all sorts of blood on the dance floor, so to speak. We saw stock markets crash. And that was that turmoil that we had then. But now we catapult to 2022 and we have this war with Ukraine. And that's something else. That's sort of affected markets. And having a look at our petrol price, in fact, there's a big debate going on now. What's going to be happening with our petrol price? Because we've got a little bit of a problem. Our government at the moment, they've taken the fuel levy. And what they basically said is for the, I think it's April and May, that 1.50 rand has been carved off the fuel levy. The thing is, next Wednesday, this all runs out. And COSATU and others are now saying to our government, government, please, 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 what we want you to do is to make sure that that fuel levy stays away. And hopefully over the next 48 hours, we'll find out more about that. Bruce in Davos, he's on his way back home now. He'll give us a full account when he does get back home. But basically, we still need to see what happened with Davos 2022.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Right, let's see what's happening with our markets. Now, it's a nice strong day today, I must admit. And portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, Viv Govender. Hi, Viv, good evening. Good to have you back on The Money Show.
Thanks for having me.
Right, so what happened with our markets today? It was lovely to see the oil share going up. We did lose quite a bit earlier on this week, but a nice recovery.
I think the basic, I'd say, is that the Fed might be blinking in terms of raising interest rates. And so we had that Fed meeting last night, and the minutes were released, and we basically saw that there is indications that they might be looking to pause after the next two rounds of rate hikes. And then today we had a revision for U.S. GDP coming out for the first quarter. The number had been minus 1.4 in the first take they'd done. The revision basically was expected to go down to 1.3, minus 1.3, and it's going to minus 1.5. So that shows that the U.S. economy may be weaker than had been hoped for. And, you know, the Fed has recently been very, very sensitive to any kind of weakness in the economy. It's an election year in the U.S., the midterm elections. It's going to be very difficult for, you know, because the Democrats who are in power on the House, Senate, and the presidency, and to win if the economy is still under pressure because of the interest rate environment. So I think that's probably one of the reasons that we are seeing that the market's rising and people are expecting the Fed not to be as aggressive as some had feared.
That's interesting. So what do you think this means for our interest rates? We've been tracking the Fed. We've been tracking what's happening in Europe as well. Does this mean perhaps that inflation may come down a little bit? Perhaps our Reserve Bank takes its foot off the accelerator and says, okay, maybe we keep the repo rate unchanged?
I think the U.S. is going to hike at least one more time, and then they might pause. I think if they do pause, it might give our Reserve Bank some the freedom to pause as well. But if, while the U.S. is still hiking, we have to hike along with them. We can't be like Turkey and decide to go our own route. And you saw what happened to the Turkish deal, right? It was a disaster when they tried to basically break market expectations. We won't be able to do that as well without having massive damage to our economy and our currency especially. So I think, yes, if the U.S. does stop, then we might have some room to stop as well. Not difficult, but we might. But if they don't stop, you know, or as long as they continue, we probably have to follow along with them at the very least.
Yeah. Let's take a look at what happened with some today. I mean, Sasol up 5%. Sasol has been such a lovely success story, hasn't it?
Well, unfortunately for anyone that drives in South Africa, that is true. You know, the reason being is that oil prices today are pretty high, you know, above the $117 a barrel again. We are seeing, you know, basically, we had a bit of a reprieve over the last month or two when China decided to go on a zero COVID policy lockdown, shutting down Shanghai and, you know, surrounding areas. Over 100 million people were locked down. That lack of demand, because I mean, if you were locked down, and a Chinese lockdown, by the way, it's not like our lockdown, but where we basically could have gone to the shops once in a while. Some people were jogging on the streets. In China, if you're locked down, you can't leave your house, even if you have no food in the house.
No, absolutely.
If your job was essential, you had to go live with the office. That's what they said. If you had an essential job, you moved to the office and stayed in the office. So, yeah, obviously no one was traveling. No cars were being moved around and so on. So we had a drop-off in global demand because of that. That helped the oil price fall a little bit. Now that China is back on track, we probably are going to be seeing, you know, oil prices once again trending higher.
Yeah. Thinking about what the U.S. did, I mean, they wanted to intervene. They sold off reserves. They wanted to try and right the market, but that didn't work, did it?
The U.S.?
Yeah, the U.S., the United States.
Look, I mean, they do always point back to the Paul Volcker's view. Paul Volcker is like a legendary figure amongst central bankers because of what he did in the early 80s, and he basically broke the back of inflation. But if you look at the chart, what he did here, when he raised interest rates initially, he brought them down very quickly because the economy started to sputter and inflation came down slightly, and he just basically stepped off the gas in terms of off the brakes, basically, because he was afraid. Then eventually he was forced to go up and really raise rates to get them, you know, higher for a bit longer and have a slow decline from the peak. That finally broke the back of inflation. I do think the U.S. inflation rate is probably not going to be as high next year as it is right now. I think there's a lot of base effects that are going to have to come into play. I mean, look at petrol prices or gasoline prices in the U.S. They are, you know, spectacularly high for their, consideration. That's probably not going to be another increase of that percentage going forward from here. We are likely to see some supply chain issues ease up. Yes, food is an issue, and that might be a bit of a longer-term issue. But I think, you know, even that will eventually, you know, work itself through. There will be other sources, other plantings happening. So I think inflation is probably going to be a little higher than they hope for, but it is going to come down a bit. And I think that's probably going to give the Fed some excuse to not be as aggressive as some had feared.
Yeah, hopefully. Let's see what happens. Not all doom and gloom. I was looking at the Life Hospital Group today. Nice results. NAMPAC as well. Anything else catch your eye?
Of course, the Grindrod African bank deal. Yeah. That's obviously very interesting as well. Look, I mean, I think the banking sector is one of those sectors that, you know, is very old, but also very ripe for disruption. It's kind of like how telecoms were, you know, 20 years ago. I think the movements in that particular region are going to be something that we are going to have to be, like, you know, one of the big stories of the next couple of decades is when you are seeing some of these, established companies take a bit of a backseat to some innovative new companies out there. We don't know, of course, who's going to be the new innovative guys out. In the U.S., we've seen online banking come into play. Even some sort of African, like mobile operators that do incredible things in banking in West East Africa. So I think that's an interesting play. But yeah, look, what happened here was the African bank was saying they want to get more into the business space. Kind of makes sense. There's more fees there. There's, you know, more transactions happening, so it might be an interesting day for them to do.
Yeah, it's been a lovely success story with African Bank. I was chatting to their CEO earlier on this week, and I must admit, it's lovely to see what's happened since 2014. But then you get UBank and some of the other smaller ones and concern about them.
Oh, yeah, look, I mean, these banking apps, we are entering a new phase. Whether it's something new, obviously there will be, you know, lots of experimentation. One could even consider stuff like the crypto stuff has been experimentation in the banking space. So I think, the invention of the internet, computers. It's been a while, but banking is eventually catching up with us. I think Elon Musk sent once, the whole banking system basically is a bunch of, 17 computers, mainframes, running, some ancient form of software. And that's basically what the entire system is based on. And there's not been much motivation. They're building on top of it, but they don't really replace stuff that's out there.
Yeah.
I think if you look at what the world looks like right now with banking and so on, look at China. I think like a majority of their transactions happen online, or basically with mobile banking. But the fraction is in Africa. That's going to be the way the world works going forward. You'll be able to buy and sell virtually anything using your phone. You'll be able to basically log into places using your phone. And what happens to all those guys with those ATM points, all those branches that use those as their point of advantage to consumers, when all that matters in the future is likely to be the app that you have on your phone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is the way of technology. Just wrapping up our Davos discussion, of course, and you mentioned cryptocurrency there. Viv, what is your take on cryptocurrency and its spread throughout the world? They had displays out. They had all sorts of, I don't know, places where you can go get themed dinners and all sorts of things. Cryptocurrency seems to be here to stay.
It may be, but I always come back to one conclusion. If you study history, you find one thing to be true. The guy with the guns wins. So the people with guns are the ones that win against the people that have pretty smart ideas. I think that cryptocurrency, one of the main drivers is decentralization, getting away from centralization and so on. The decentralized finance, DeFi basically, as they call it. One of the reasons to do that is to basically avoid some of the government pitfalls out there. Government is more centralized, government is more, concentrated, and you want to get escape that kind of boundary. Government doesn't like that kind of stuff. I mean, they will make something illegal just because it makes it more difficult for them to attack them, or makes it more difficult for them to understand where the wealth is coming from to combat money laundering. There's many things that are, on the face of it, rather interesting things to do, but the government intervention and government regulation makes it impossible to do. So I do think that down the line, until we see a point where government basically starts to accept it, besides the government of some small country in South America, when the EU or when the US starts accepting the stuff, we'll be a bit more comfortable. But until then, I do think there's a cap to just how strong they can be.
Yeah, let's watch the space. Portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, Viv Governor. Thank you so much for being with us on The Money Show tonight. A very interesting discussion.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA CIB, igniting economic collaboration through trust at the 2022 World Economic Forum. That's Africanacity. APSA's a registered FSP.
Right, so let's have a look now at the Life Healthcare Group. They've released their financial results. Group revenue climbed 4.2% to 13.5 billion rand for the period, pointing to operational resilience within the group. In fact, these results are really good. This is as the world slowly emerges from the COVID-19 pandemic. Group revenue consisted of a 4.5% increase in Southern African revenue to 9.5 billion rand and increased international revenue by 1.8% to 3.8 billion. Growth initiatives contributed a further 232 million rand. So these are good results post-COVID. We live in a post-COVID world now. Although I am looking at the latest COVID-19 figures, 16 deaths in the last 24-hour recorded period and 3,801 new cases of COVID-19. So perhaps we're not out of it just yet. But on the other hand, we've not seen the figures we saw this time last year. Joining us is the CEO at the Life Healthcare Group, Peter Watson Hood. Hi, Peter. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray, and well summarized.
Thank you. Now, look, these are good results. We've come out of this COVID-19 period. How is your group now adjusting to, I don't want to say post-COVID-19 conditions, because we've got these conditions right now, but how are you adjusting as we emerge from last year?
I think we've probably got to put this COVID wave into perspective. So our clinicians and statisticians have said we're in the peak of COVID wave 5. At an absolute level of hospitalizations in the Life Healthcare Group, we're a shade over 300. Compare that to the peak of Delta, where we were just shy of 2,300. So a significantly different perspective at a hospital level. And that's probably ascribed to the efficacy of the vaccinations, the cumulative immunity developing in society, and people just behaving more responsibly than perhaps they were doing a year ago.
Do you sorry, Peter, just before you carry on, do you have to then factor that in? I'm just thinking about that. Do you factor in the fact that you are going to get less patients, that people are going to become more immune?
Yes, and in that context, there's a dynamic that plays out in the hospital model. If you will recall, in the early days of COVID, people were very scared of hospitals. They didn't go to the dentist, they didn't go to their GP, and certainly didn't go to their specialists. So the hospital volumes were significantly down. Elective surgeries ground to a halt, and the large concentration of cases in hospitals that were being treated were largely COVID. In that sense, if you wind the clock forward, we have a very different perspective in our hospital setting as of today. You know, reduced numbers of COVID cases significantly. People are far less sick. In Delta, 48% of the COVID hospitalized patients ended up in ICU, and the comparator now is about 14%. Most of the COVID patients hospitalized are in general ward, and very few on supplemental oxygen. And the hospital level death rate, or hospital admission death rate, has gone from 1 in 5, that's a scary number that we had in Delta, to 1 in 50.
Sure.
So there's a completely different shift, and the clinicians describe this now as an endemic virus. It'll be around for years to come. And its efficacy in spreading is obviously greater and moves through society, but its acuity or the severity of the illness that it then brings to bear on a human, we see it as less. And clearly, vaccination helps, no question about it. And our own internal statistics back that up 100%.
Yeah, a lot of people still arguing that, but get vaccinated. That's the bottom line, certainly is. When looking at those vaccinations and people sort of vaccinations tapering off, did that affect your bottom line at all? Did that affect your hospitals at all? Or did you just need to re-strategize and say, like you've said, we're going in another direction?
No, we're going in another direction. And the Life Healthcare Group, I'm proud to say, has got a vaccination rate in South Africa of 89% with 100% vaccination rate in the head office. And our international operations are north of 90%. And when we look at our own internal statistics and how the efficacy of the vaccine improved the outcomes for healthcare workers in Life Healthcare, the math speaks overwhelmingly in favor that vaccination has made a significant difference. But yeah. Significant.
Sure, that's interesting. Let's change tack a little bit. Take us through your international operations. They've also seen growth, haven't they?
They have, and the reported numbers don't tell the story about underlying operating activity. For the two exceptions that are in the base year against which we're comparing, in the base year we've got the profit on the disposal of our Poland operations called ScanMed, so that profit is in the base. And in the prior six-month period, we also responded to a request from the NHS to provide COVID emergency services to deal with the specific backlog that had been built up in the system. And that contract came to an end at the end of September. So a pretty heavy base against which the international operations are being compared. So if we go to the underlying operating activity, we'll see that there's been a significant increase in demand for our services. Our Irish operations increased the number of scans that they did by 26%. In the UK operations, demand for our PET CT scanning services rose by 13.5%, which puts us nearly 35% ahead of where we were in 2019. And what we are seeing is the governments in the UK, Italy and Ireland are absolutely determined to get rid of the backlog. They're applying resources and money at the effort, and we are a partner of choice to help service them and one of their biggest service providers.
That's so interesting. But they've got NHI. Is it just the pure scale of what they're facing?
There is definitely levels of cooperation between public and private in the NHS system in the UK and the HSE and the ASL in Italy and Ireland, respectively. That is worthy of comment that we have demonstrated that when public and private work together, you get much better social outcomes. And in so doing, we are a significant provider to all three governments' healthcare systems. We have learned how to do business with them and them with us. And it works very well for both parties.
Sure. That's quite interesting because I suppose that's also a very big lesson for this country because our governments still want the same sort of system. But you're right, if it's a partnership like that, this could really work for us.
Yes, it's an absolute imperative. And in our parliamentary subcommittee representation on the NHR, we have obviously endorsed the quest for universal healthcare and access for all. No disputing that. But the methodology by which our government wants to implement it, we have a different mindset. Private has a very significant role to play, and government has a responsibility to implement the NHI, I think, in a building block approach. There's so much of the discussion is around single payer, the merits of a single payer system and where's the money coming from. Our problems are far more basic than that and need to be put on the table and addressed. We're short of 21,000 nurses in this country while staring a crisis in the face. We are short of doctors. So we are short of hospital managers. So if we really want to tackle this problem of improving the delivery of healthcare in South Africa, address those two fundamentals. You don't need a new act to be able to go and address those. You've got to start tackling that problem now. Yeah. And we are outspoken on all three of those topics.
Yeah. All right, that then leads me to my next question, because it sounds like you do have a lot of these. What are your future growth areas? I would think there would be many.
And this is a really pleasing part of my job, in that we are fortunate that we are not just a hospital operator in South Africa and not just an imaging services company delivering services in the Northern Hemisphere. We have this unique and diversified footprint that allows us to bring to bear skills in different regions. In the context of our entry into the imaging market, the non-clinical aspect of imaging and radiology in South Africa, we are applying the principles and expertise that the Alliance Medical Group has been deploying for more than a decade, very, very successfully, in the Northern Hemisphere. In addition to which, we also are the largest vertically integrated network of PET-CT provision, that's molecular imaging, in Europe. And we are, together with Axon, where we signed a joint venture, our first site will be a dual cyclotron site in Midrand, the first dual cyclotron site in South Africa. And of that, we believe a PET-CT capability will be developed in this country. We are way behind the delivery of PET-CT capability compared to the likes of America, Scandinavia, the UK, and others.
Sure. That's very interesting. It's also quite scary as well. CEO at the Life Healthcare Group, Peter Wattenhood, good to chat to you and good to see that we are giving quality healthcare because it's light in Italy, it's light in the UK, also Ireland as well. Good, strong chat this evening.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
But let's keep discussing results, because it gives such a lovely picture of what's happening with our local economy, what's happening with our business. And I know a lot of businesses are struggling, but not all. And you see share prices going up, and you can actually see development, because after results come out, you can see share prices climb. Nampak has announced the group's interim results for the 6 months to the 31st of March this year. The company says the first 6 months of the financial year were characterized by robust trading conditions in key markets. The metals businesses were the main contributors to revenue and trading profit growth for Nampak. While trading profit improved by 9% to 770 million rand, the group did see trading margins contract to 9.5% from 10.8%, but operating profit grew 26% to 668 million rand. Joining us is the CEO at Nampak, Eric Smuts. Hi, Eric. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray, and thank you very much, and all the best to your listeners.
Thank you. Eric, robust trading conditions in key markets. Explain what you've been going through.
Ray, I think that, first of all, let me explain in which markets we operate. And we are essentially a beverage can producer, and we also operate in some other packaging substrates. But the biggest portion of our market comes from beverage cans. And particularly in South Africa, we had very strong demand as a result of, you know, increased beer sales and also in energy drinks. So a very interesting trend, a lot of sales of energy drinks and quite a healthy recovery in the local market.
Well, that's good to hear. But now commodity prices going up, metals costing more. Is this affecting your bottom line?
Yes, it does, in two ways. Firstly, we had to recover those costs from our customers, and as a result of those elevated prices, automatically you would have seen a contraction in margins. The other impact is the additional investment required in working capital that generally is not recovered through your traditional pricing mechanisms, and as a result, the interest costs. The cost of capital on those additional working capital requirements that we had to fund ourselves, and that did have a negative impact on our
Yeah. Looking at your operations, also Nigeria and Angola, just take us through what's happening there. I'm talking about your metals division, also growing, I mean, 27% to 6 billion rand. That's lovely. That's lovely growth.
Absolutely. Let me start with Nigeria first. It's a much bigger market overall. We did experience growth there, although sort of maybe at a lower level. We've got a fantastic operation there on the beverage can side, making it's literally a world-class operation, but it's very difficult trading conditions, mainly as a result of macroeconomic factors. And I want to say the way how the central bank is controlling, if I can call it that, the access to foreign currency. It makes it extremely challenging to operate in that environment, because you just cannot get the amount of dollars that you need for raw materials. Mm. Or if you do get it, it's at quite a premium to the official price. Where in Angola, smaller market, but I think bigger growth off a lower base. And we found that the impact of the higher oil price certainly had a positive impact in that economy, and we did not have any problems to secure dollars for raw material purchasing.
Yeah. Talking earlier, though, you said the South African beverage can market experienced strong growth. You must have been very worried during COVID-19 when people weren't drinking, they weren't going out, and alcohol sales were banned.
Absolutely. I mean, we had a numerous alcohol bans, and interesting enough, the bigger knock that we took was on the soft drink side, where with the lack of major events or even those thousands of little school events not taking place, your typical immediate consumption packs like cans and smaller bottles were not selling, and we lost a huge amount of volume as a result. But that is now recovering and starting to look a lot better.
Final question, where are you going in the next couple of years? I mean, do you also have worry areas?
Yes, I mean, we keep on evaluating our African footprint. We've got lots of smaller operations in Africa where we sometimes question whether it is worth the effort. We also have larger operations like, as I mentioned, in Nigeria and Angola. And we keep on looking to see whether that's actually giving us a fair return on capital. So, you know, a big portion of the discount at which the Nampak share price is trading at is as a result of our constrained balance sheet, and therefore that's an area we have to address to unlock value.
Interesting. CEO at Nampak, Eric Smuts, good to have you on The Money Show this evening.
702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DSTV channel 856.
Just gone 6 minutes past 7 o'clock. Ray in for Bruce on The Money Show. Now, The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, igniting economic collaboration through trust at the 2022 World Economic Forum. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Coming up on your program in the next hour, talking about African Bank acquiring 100% stake of Grindrod Bank, which will allow it to accelerate its entry into the South African business banking sector. Interesting move this to see what's happening with African Bank. And earlier on this week, we actually spoke to the CEO at African Bank talking about their results, and the results very strongly actually. And looks like they've taken another step. The only thing is, I think they were going to list, and I'm not sure if this affects their listing or what time period that'll be. I'll be chatting to Zweli Manyati, he's the Group Executive for Business Banking at African Bank, shortly about this one. Then also talking about how to set your strategy and stick to it despite the changes that may arise. Pavlos Fotidis, he's the founder at Auric Business Accelerator. He'll tell us about that. Stick to your initial choice and don't be swayed by what's happening around the world. And then in our personal finance feature tonight, how to protect yourself from panic when markets drop. That's Warren Ingram. He's also a personal financial advisor and the executive director at Galileo Capital. Of course, I'd like to hear from you. Leave me a WhatsApp note on 072-702-1702. Or perhaps you just want to SMS. Well, you can, you know. You can send an SMS on 31702 or 31567.
702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
Well, like I said, African Bank has acquired 100% of Grindrod Bank, which will allow it to accelerate its entry into the South African business banking sector. Grindrod Bank is wholly owned by Grindrod Limited. The deal is worth 1.5 billion rand. So there's lots at stake here. African Bank's CEO, Kennedy Bungani, I spoke to him earlier on this week. He says, following the release of our successful half-year results this week, our acquisition of Grindrod Bank enables us to further realize certain goals. Well, joining us is Group Executive for Business Banking at African Bank, Zweli Manyati. Hi, Zweli. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you for having me.
All right. You heard what the CEO had to say. What are those further business goals? Why have you made this acquisition?
Well, Ray, if you go back to the Accelerate 25 that Kennedy would have spoken about, one of the, what he called the strategic pillars, is expanding the core of the bank. And what that means is that we need to diversify the balance sheet of the bank as well as where it generates income into different products that we haven't up to now been giving to customers, as well as going to markets. Like business banking, which we were not playing in. So the strategic optionality that Grindrod acquisition gives us is an entry into business banking, which is an ambition that was articulated in strategy Accelerate 25.
Okay, that sounds solid. It certainly does. What is Grindrod Bank anyway? I mean, I know we know Grindrod, they do freight and things like that. What is Grindrod Bank, though?
Ray, Grindrod Bank has been around for a while and has operated as a boutique investment bank or corporate bank. And they've been mainly on the lending side of things, and we are specialist in public finance, and they do some NERS funding. So really and truly, they've been a boutique. And for us, the fact that over time they've begun to expand their focus in the market and begin to look at what I call the middle of the pyramid in the business banking market, that made them very attractive to us, because in our definition of what it is that African Bank wants to do is to become a solid player to solve for the pain points of entrepreneurs in that part of the pyramid. So for us, they also bring quite a bit. Not only do they bring products, they bring teams that have been at it for a long time, about 26 years they've been doing this.
Okay, all right. So what does this mean for staff? Or are, like you say, you're just bringing the various teams on, everything will stay the same?
To a very large extent, there are certain areas where, as you can imagine, we're two banks, we've got two banking licenses. We've got to give up a banking license. And from a regulatory standpoint, we'll be expected to have one reporting from to all the regulatory authorities. So there are going to be areas that we are going to have to quickly look at how to rationalize, to present one picture, consistent picture across the group. But the front end of the business, which is your product teams, your coverage and business development teams, those teams are likely are going to actually stay intact, because African Bank was beginning to build a team on the one hand, and they have a team.
Right.
So we'll pull the good of the two and get on to meet our customer demands and needs.
Okay, makes sense. What are the time frames for the deal then?
So today we signed all the necessary agreement, which enables us to announce the deal, as would have been seen in all the census that went out. The next phase is a regulatory one, where we've got to go to the Reserve Bank, we've got to go to the Minister of Finance, the National Credit Authority, the Competition Commission. We have to run all of these in parallel where it is possible, because what we want to do is shorten the time from now to the consummation of the deal or the transaction, because those are the conditions precedents of the deal. And we are already going to have to begin to think about what is the 100-day plan looks like. From a people perspective, you know, you got to make sure that because banking is an IP industry, so it's people who make the difference. So you better make sure that as you buy the bank, you keep a good part of the people who are in Grindrod. And we've made some calls around how to get that done.
Okay. It's a competitive business banking market, and any South African will tell you that somebody's trying to get their business. Being so competitive, what are you hoping to offer that's going to have people going, hey, you know what, let's go to African Bank, they've got this great new arm and things really work there?
So you're right, Ray. If we were to go in there on the basis that all we're going to deliver is products, I would tell you that our chance would be just as good as any other bank. But what we have been doing is look at what are the key drivers of a success in the entrepreneurs. Why are entrepreneurs failing? And what are the things that we believe are missing in the propositions that are out there? And one conclusion we've come to is it's not just about delivering banking products and services. It's about understanding those drivers for success, and it's about investing yourself in building partnerships that enables you to give that support that enables businesses to grow by skilling them, by making sure that they don't have to spend time on administrative tasks like I have to pay tax, I've got to do this. because all of those things take them away from focusing on growing their businesses. So our proposition is not just about come get the best product from us, because, you know, product competitiveness gets blunted very, very quickly. Ours is to say philosophically, our success is going to be how strong we support South African entrepreneurs to grow, because their sustainability matters to us as a bank.
That's really good news. Really, that really is good news. I mean, small business in our country is vital. If you have a look at our president and what he's had to say is promote small business, get business going, get investment into this country, because then things grow and grow and grow and grow. Will you then have tailor-made packages for small business that they, so to speak, will know we can go to them because they'll give us a better deal than, say, the bigger banks? Now, talk about the bigger banks. Talk about the Nedbank, Standard Banks, etc.
So when we succeed, Ray, you'll hear businesses saying, the reason I am a success in my business is because I bank with African Bank. So it matters, therefore, to us to make sure that as much as, you know, we think about, you know, this thing called mass customization, that thing called mass customization must be informed by a proper engagement and research to confirm our going in position around these are the areas that are pain points. If we remove these, what does it do for your business? So it's going to be an iterative process, but we are comfortable that our view of things is that you don't build it and hope that they will come.
Yeah.
You co-create with the customer.
Sure, that's very interesting. I like that. I'll have to leave it there. Group Executive for Business Banking at African Bank, Zweli Manyati. Thank you so much and good luck for your new venture. It sounds very exciting.
Thank you very much, Ray.
702.
SMS us now on 31702.
Right, we'll be chatting shortly to Pavla Fatidis. He's the founder at Auric Business Accelerator. How to set your strategy and stick to it. And it sounds like Zweli really does have a very good strategy. It sounds like they're onto something. And it's good to see that Grindrod Bank has now been bought up 100%, and this will give them some sort of strategy to go ahead. The thing is, and I think this comes down to with our discussion with Pavla Fatidis, who's the founder at Auric Business Accelerator. Once you have your strategy, Pavlo, you've got to stick to it, don't you, despite the changes that may arise. Hi, good to have you back on The Money Show.
Thanks, Ray. And, you know, those words couldn't be more important in the environment we find ourselves in. Because let's face it, right now in South Africa, if you start to add up all the activities that create consternation in people, we remain with a government that seems incapable of putting our country on a proper growth path, on creating an environment of transparency, on nation building and alignment. We remain with the same problems with Eskom. We've got horrible cold weather. We've got the floods in KZN. We've got this ridiculous instance of the flagpole, which is now going to be used as a symbol and as a metaphor for ongoing government incompetence around just putting us in a position where we can win. And all of those things start to rack and stack in the mind of a business owner. Inflation is creeping in. It's coming through in the petrol price. It's coming through in food. And all that noise, all that noise starts to create uncertainty in you as an individual, because you as an individual in your business are the leader of the business. And the problem with the word leader has got two elements to it, two Latin derivatives, leader and leader. And what they each mean, leader is from the front, and leader is one foot in front of the next, in front of the next, in front of the next. So it's about leading from the front in a direction to a destination that gives the team behind you confidence that you know what you're doing and how you're going to get there. And all these elements that I spoke of earlier start gnawing away at your confidence, at whether you are doing the right thing, the loneliness of the entrepreneurial endeavor and the entrepreneurial journey. And the thing that concerns me most, Ray, is when people start to chop and change strategy based on the latest piece of news or the latest piece of negative news that feeds into the business environment itself.
Yeah, I see that's very difficult, and people do that. But it's so difficult not to get distracted. It's a bit like investing in the stock market. You invest in something, and then your share price starts going down, and you go, hoo, better withdraw it right now. In fact, Warren Ingram's going to be talking about this. Better withdraw this right now. It's the same sort of thing. People don't play the long game.
No, they don't play the long game. And here's the thing. There's a wonderful, wonderful formula in physics, and it's the formula for momentum. And the formula says momentum equals mass times velocity. So mass is the weight that you build behind the object you're trying to create momentum in. And velocity is the change of location from one instance to the next, but in a direction. Okay, so just bear with me on this.
Okay.
As a business owner, imagine yourself out at sea sailing a ship. And that's your business. Your ship has crew. Your ship has an engine. Your ship has a bridge. Your ship has the ability to be navigated by you. Out at sea, things are unpredictable. You get waves, you get currents, you get storms, you get all sorts of dangerous environments that can threaten the existence and the safe travel of the ship. You need to see yourself as the captain of the ship, because your crew looks up to you in order to get the ship from one place to the next safely. And that means using the equation of momentum, that every time that propeller turns, despite what's happening out in that sea, that propeller needs to get you closer to your destination. So using that as a metaphor, given the environment we're in, I fundamentally believe that every business owner should only have one strategy behind their business, and that's to build it in what we refer to as an asset of value. And an asset of value, Ray, offers three elements to it.
Yeah.
The first thing it offers you is growth in your revenue, so income growth. The second thing is it offers you profitability, a deepening profitability. And the third thing is that it offers you the ability to enjoy both growth in income and increasing profits, largely independent of you. And that matters because ultimately, the only destination that you would want to sail your ship to needs to be a port that you can arrive at safely, where you can offload your value. In business terms, you're building a business that of a day, you are sure you are able to sell it and reap the capital gain as a reward for all the risk you've taken over the 5, 10, 15, 20 years of getting there. That's the strategy. There should be no other strategy. How are you going to get there will change depending on the winds, on the storms that lie ahead. You might take a different tack or a different path or a different direction. But in the back of your mind, you must always be thinking, the strategy behind my business is to build a business that of a day, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, I can successfully sell. And between now and then, I've got to create an environment where I'm moving in that direction definitively, outside of the mutterings of some politician, or outside of the rand dollar moving up and down, outside of the inflation figures. I will find a different path depending on what those small storms look like.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I do what I do to build an asset of value.
But just in hearing you say that, Pavlo, don't you also have to sometimes alter your course? Don't you have to sometimes say, technology comes along and all of a sudden we're not using cameras with film, we're using digital cameras. In fact, radio, I was reading the story about the BBC. They're axing 1,000 jobs because all of a sudden they're going to digitize things, they're going to go online and you just don't need the people anymore. Do you not have to adjust that way?
Absolutely, you have to. And that's no different to sailing the ship. If you think about it, you're sailing the ship, the next minute, a lever of change, something that changes the environment you're sailing in, becomes apparent. So you see on your radar a storm busy brewing and forming directly in your path. The idea then is to say, well, the storm's moving from east to west. If I veer to the east now, by the time I arrive there, the storm would have passed, and then I can reorientate my direction back to that same destination that I was sailing to prior to the storm. So you tack, when you're sailing a ship, you tack in and out of the winds, you tack in and out of the currents, you move in and out of areas that are dangerous, but the direction is you're still sailing to that same port, you're still building an asset of value.
Mm.
It's vital to be able to adapt to that environment.
Yeah.
And then the question is, well, how do you get that right?
Yeah.
Because if you are busy, if you're in the engine room of your ship, in other words, you're below decks and you're working those diesel engines to keep the propeller turning, that's not where a ship gets steered. A ship gets steered from the bridge.
You need help, don't
it's
you?
Where you climb. Yeah, exactly. You need to build a business where the engine can turn and turn and turn, but where you spend most of your time on the bridge and you can see on your radar where the storms are. You can see which direction to tack and veer in order to miss the storm, but to keep on track to move to that destination, the final port that you want to arrive at. And that's what's concerning me at the moment a lot, because the pressures that everyone's facing, the sense of self-doubt that it creates in you, pulls you back down into the day-to-day, week-to-week, hour-to-hour operational activities of a business. And when times are tough, leadership matters more than doing. You need to be on that bridge. You need to be leading the company. You need to be leading your team. You need to be giving people confidence that you're on track despite the difficulties in the marketplace.
Yeah, yeah. And also family businesses as well. Now, I was chatting to Healy Khan last night, so of Continental Linen. I love the chat we had.
Yes.
He does his own adverts, okay? The guy goes and he climbs and he does his own adverts. He's got his daughter, his son-in-law, everybody working for him. But that's leadership. That's the whole thing about he's got a vision. Are visions like that, though, quite rare? It's not for everybody to have that vision that says, I will do the advert because I know what I'm doing. Very often, you pass that down to a family member and the person's clueless.
Yeah, you know what? Vision is essential in my view, because if you don't have a vision, then what are you doing? And the best way to know whether you have a vision or not, Ray, as a business owner, is to actually sit down. And I would encourage everyone to do this right now. Sit down, pull out a sheet of paper, and start writing down what you did on Monday, hour by hour, blow by blow. Write it down.
Okay.
Write down Tuesday. Write down Wednesday. Write down today, Thursday, what you did from this morning to where you are now, this evening. And then start, get a highlighting pen, literally, and everything that is administrative, mark it yellow. Everything that is operational, market green, everything that is to do with working with your team, people, a market blue, anything to do with customers, market pink, and anything to do with suppliers, market purple.
Purple,
for example.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah. And then start to look at what the color of your week looks like. And ask yourself, of all the activity in the week, where did I do things? And where did I lead things? Because lead means you're working with your team to do what needs to be done in order to get a job of work done. Doing means that you worked alongside with your team, getting your hands dirty, interfering with your team, micromanaging your team.
Yeah.
Because you're concerned that it might not be done in the manner that you want it done, or you're concerned that if it's not done properly, there's going to be a big cost in the business.
Mm.
It'll give you a very good insight as to whether you are working in the business or on the business. What you've just mentioned with Healy Khan.
Yeah.
And Healy's got his kids in the business. He's got a second generation coming through that business too. He has a vision for Continental Linen to be the best at what it does within the market environment that it's trading in.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
So if you don't have that vision, then what are you doing day in and day out? Mostly you're going to find yourself doing the work, and doing the work does not build a business. Doing the work generates income, but income in its own right does not create a saleable business. And those individuals that continue with that pattern of behavior Oh, man, Ray.
Yeah.
They make up the 94.6% of businesses that are started that never, ever, ever get sold.
Sure.
And that's tragic.
That is scary, Pavlov. That is so scary. And, of course, in your color chart, you've got to have green, you see. You've got to be able to see the money at the end going, I'm going to go for that. That's the green is the most important color. That's what I was thinking about. Pavlov Fatidis from Orica Business Accelerator, thank you so much for coming onto the show and brightening up our Thursday. You see, we've got a green color now, something to aim for. It's just gone 7:30.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, igniting economic collaboration through trust at the 2022 World Economic Forum. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
22 minutes to 8 o'clock now. Personal finance and how to protect yourself from panic when markets drop. Our guest, of course, is Warren Ingram. He's a personal financial advisor and also the executive director at Galileo Capital. Hi, Warren. Good evening. Good to chat to you again.
Thanks so much, Ray. It feels like it's you and me on the show every Thursday nowadays. I think, you know, Bruce gallivanting around the world.
Yeah, what's that about? You know, he just cracks the nod to Davos and you and I sit here and, you know, discuss the world's problems. It should be the other way around.
I must say I'm feeling rather left out.
Oh, that's all right. We just want to share with him when he gets back. But one thing we will share is knowledge and how to protect yourself from panic when markets drop. And this is the big thing because markets are very volatile. I was looking at the All Share today. Lovely. It's back. It's up because the US Fed is a little bit cautious now on interest rates. But tomorrow they may say, you know what, we're going to slash their rate by, say, 1 percentage point or something. And then we follow suit and then the markets drop and it all goes to hell. What should you do not to panic?
Well, I'm glad that you're quoting the US Fed because I think it's at the moment a lot of what's going on with the JSE is dictated by global events and to a large extent global events are dictated by what happens in the US. So, focusing on what the US market does will give us a really good indication of what's going to happen to us. And I think the first thing is when markets fall, it's really key to have a context to what's going on. Why are markets falling? You might not know exactly, but if you get a good sense that this is, you know, really a global event, it's not unique to South Africa, maybe not even unique to emerging markets. It's something that's being driven globally. It's important to get a sense of, you know, are we in kind of a spring tide? You know, is this kind of like one of those major once in a 200-year events? Because once you've got some kind of context to how big the fall is and potentially how much pain you're going to go through, you also have a sense of what recovery will look like. So I thought it was interesting just to give you an idea, Ray, of what happens to the U.S. market when it falls. And, important to kind of just remember that the U.S. market falls by about 10% every 2 years. So kind of every second year, the U.S. market has a drop of 10%. When that happens, you and I will be talking about quite a big drop in the markets and, yeah, you know, investors are losing out, that they're getting a little bit fearful, et cetera. Because, you know, 10% is a big number. You know, you've got R1 million invested. So suddenly, you know, you see it sitting at 900,000 rand. It's a number that will scare a lot of people. Mm. But that's not where we are. Where we are now is that, the US market is, you know, as you say, depending on the day, it's probably down about 20%. Now, the US market falls by about 30% every 4 to 5 years. So when we talk about the long term in stock markets, we generally will talk about a time frame of kind of 5 to 8 years. So what you would say to someone in that situation is, if I tell you, I think you will make very good returns from the stock market as a whole over a 5 to 8 year period, implicit in that is that you are going to experience a loss of 30% in one of those years out of the next 5 to 8 years, and maybe even two drops of 30% over an 8 year period. And I'm crazy enough to tell you that will still be, you'll still get the good returns of investing in the stock market. So I think it's important to say, I'm not predicting, yeah, how much the US market's going to fall and therefore how much it's going to drop the JSE. What I'm saying is a fall of 20% is normal. This happens, okay, every few years. And if that's normal, and then this is by no means the end of the world. No matter what we're reading in the media, no matter what the talking heads are saying, we've seen this kind of a movie many, many, many times before, and therefore we know what happens. What will happen is when the kind of prognosticators will, especially fund managers and investment strategists and economists start saying, almost universally start saying, we expect major recession. We expect that this could be a multi-decade low. And, investors should really not expect any kind of growth from their investments for the next 10, 15 years. When they're all universally gloomy, you should start to spar. You should start to say to yourself, this stage of market collapse has a name. It happens so often. It's got a name.
Yeah.
It's called capitulation, right?
Okay.
And I don't think we're there yet. People haven't kind of given up completely on investing as a whole, but they are starting to get increasingly panicky and more people getting more and more gloomy. And for me, I'm watching this and I'm saying to myself, okay, I think we're getting close. We're getting close to capitulation point. As an investor, if I'm looking at this, I take the view to zoom out. I don't look at what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't look at what's going to happen in 2 or 3 weeks' time, because the reality is neither you nor I nor anybody in Davos knows exactly what's going to happen in the next few hours or few days or few weeks. We can speculate, but we don't actually know. So it's important to zoom out and say, what's going to happen over 5 years from now? What's going to happen over 10 years from now? The money I'm investing, can I afford to leave it invested for that long period of time? Because if I can, what I should be doing is I should be taking any cash I've got, feeding it into the investment markets over the next sort of 3 to 6 months, and buy the shares, especially quality shares, quality indices everyone else is selling now because they're panicking. And I'm going to make good money out of their panic. I would hope they don't panic, but unfortunately, they panic so regularly that we give it a name, a capitulation, don't forget.
Yeah. I'm listening to you. This is very interesting, capitulation. But then, okay, so what happens next? Because this is going down, 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 and what goes down has to come up.
Exactly right. So what we're experiencing is the reestablishment of financial gravity. And to me, financial gravity looks like inflation, that we have some form of inflation around the world, and more especially, more critically, that we see that places like the US, especially Europe, actually charge interest to people who need to borrow money, and those that can store money on deposit, that they actually earn interest. Because surprise, surprise, that really hasn't been the case, at least since the year 2008. And certainly for most professional investors in the US or in Europe, they don't even know what inflation looks like unless they're older than 45. So we're in an environment now where South African investors are looking at this and saying, gee, we understand this incredibly well. We know what inflation is. We know what it is to pay high levels of interest on debt, and we know what it is to earn interest on debt. So now that financial gravity is reestablishing itself, it's important to take your point, Ray, which is if things go up forever, they'll come down. And equally, if things go down for a period of time, they'll turn and start going up again. So to answer your question, I hate to waffle, but to answer your question, I think we see markets staying low for a while. I don't know what a while is. Maybe till the end of the year.
Yeah.
And once investors around the world have got a grip on what inflation looks like in the US and in Europe, then they'll know what the central banks are going to do. At some point, the Fed will stop raising interest rates. And I think maybe, the markets got a little bit excited, today, and the Americans, last night and today again, thinking that they know that maybe, inflation isn't going to be as scary as they thought, and therefore interest rates won't go up as much as they thought. Who knows what happens tomorrow? But once the markets get a grip on this, then they'll start to price in a recovery. They'll start to price in that the world's not going to end, and surprise, surprise, business will carry on and things will go up again. And by then, once they start to do that, you need to be fully invested, because markets will recover really quickly. And sitting on the sidelines and waiting for the news headlines to get better and for the prognosticators to tell us that the world's turned and everything's going to be rosy and sunny again, by the time that happens, the savvy investors who've been invested have started to make good money again. And I think that's the cycle you want to break if you're an investor. You don't want to be part of this herd behavior that continuously repeats the same mistakes you know, market cycle after market cycle. Yeah. You know, you've got to, you can't be part of that name, you know, the recovery after the capitulation. You know, that it's just silly to kind of keep falling prey to that emotional response. Yeah. I'm not saying I don't understand it. It's human nature to be emotional when you see, you know, your million rand suddenly become 700,000 rand and there's some guy on the radio who says, don't worry about it, everything's going to be great. I appreciate the emotion attached to this. But the point is, you know, humans are individually rather intelligent. But the moment you put lots and lots of human beings together in bigger and bigger crowds, unfortunately, they become less and less intelligent as a collective.
You see,
and the biggest collective are investment markets.
You see, it's because we get into that herd mentality, and that's the big problem, right? Our guest tonight, Warren Ingram, our personal financial advisor, also executive director at Galileo Capital. I want to chat to Warren shortly. You can take a break now, but shortly about what happens if, say, for instance, the Fed gets it wrong.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, igniting economic collaboration through trust at the 2022 World Economic Forum. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
Right, Warren, talking about how to protect yourself from panic when the markets drop. But what happens if the Fed goes up and goes down? And they do this sometimes. 1 minute you have Jerome Powell saying, oh, you know what, hold on a second, interest rates are, we need to increase them. And then all of a sudden today you go, well, maybe not. Doesn't this get a little bit of higgledy-piggledy? You don't quite know what you're doing.
I hope they know what they're doing, Ray, because I think, you know, the real concern they have is this beast called inflation, you know, and inflation is like that snowball that goes down the hill. You know, it's very hard to stop once it gets a certain size and a certain momentum. So the danger will be that they increase interest rates too fast in their attempt to control inflation. And what they end up doing is putting the whole US economy into recession. And then you get the situation where you might have rising prices, in other words, you know, high inflation, more people losing their jobs and companies struggling to grow. It is a possibility. I think that it's important to remember the U.S. Central Bank, the U.S. Fed, has a dual mandate, which makes them very rare in the world of central banks. You know, for example, in South Africa, the central bank here only focuses on inflation. But the U.S. central bankers, they have two mandates. They must focus on inflation and they must focus on employment in the U.S. So they will be also very careful not to take such drastic action controlling inflation that they suddenly cause employment to start declining. In other words, unemployment to start rising. So it's impossible to be, you know, perfect and accurate with these things. But I think that they're so careful at the moment of forecasting far ahead as to what they're thinking, how they want to raise interest rates, that they're trying their best not to shock the market in any way and to give the market as much time as possible to absorb the news of rising rates and therefore, you know, allow the market to make sort of more rational decisions because they've got more time. But I think if the Fed gets to a situation where they realize inflation has turned the corner, in other words, it's starting to go down and it's going down faster than they anticipate, I think the Fed will be very quick to signal to markets that they're going to stop raising rates before they start to signal that they will start to decline rates. But that signal to the market that, hey, we've stopped raising interest rates. In fact, that last 0.5% or 0.25%, whatever it is that we were forecasting we would do in 2 months' time, we're not doing that. I think markets will take that news really positively, Ray, and I think it will actually cause quite a big upturn in markets again. So I'm not too concerned about them stopping, you know, interest rate hikes. What I'm very concerned about is that they have to raise them for, you know, more for longer because they can't control inflation. Sure. That's really the thing I would be focusing on.
Right, I've got a listener's question here for you, and I love throwing these at you. It says here, good day, sir or madam. We can call us sirs. My name is Lawrence. I'm a big fan of Warren's books. You've got a fan. I feel like they are the most understandable and executable pieces of financial advice I've come across. Thank you, Warren, for what you do. It's very nice. I'm a fan of Warren Buffett as well, and I know you are, Warren, and would like to invest in Berkshire Hathaway. I see I can buy equities on Easy Equities in dollars, which is not as affordable as the ETNs in rands. My questions are, what are ETNs and how do they compare with ETFs in terms of risks and attractiveness? And that's from Lawrence.
Thanks, Lawrence. I really appreciate the compliments. It's nice to now have a fan. I appreciate that. Thank you. So, very quickly, because I can talk about this for years, and I know we've limited time. Firstly, just the difference between an exchange-traded fund, an ETF, and an exchange-traded note, ETN. So an exchange-traded fund is very similar to a unit trust, and that means that when you buy an exchange-traded fund, you are buying, let's say you buy an exchange-traded fund on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange where that represents the top 40 index. What you really are buying is physical assets. In other words, cash is going into fund. That cash is being used to buy the top 40 shares on the JSE, the same 40 shares that are represented in the top 40 index. So you're actually a part owner of a physical portfolio of shares. So your risk in an exchange-traded fund is simply stock market risk, whether those shares collectively go up or down or sideways, or do they pay dividends or don't they? But you've got very little other risk other than stock market risk. With an exchange-traded note, it's rather a different beast. An exchange-traded note is an investment that's issued by a bank. And what they do is the bank says, If you buy this note, we're going to give you the performance of the index. So your risk there is firstly the stock market risk. Will that index go up or down? But secondly, you're actually giving your money to the bank and you're taking the risk that bank is still going to be around. In other words, you're taking the credit risk of the bank because the bank's not going to go and physically buy those assets and hold them for you. They're going to go and use that money to buy derivatives and certain bonds and other instruments to give you the performance of that index. But if that bank goes bankrupt, you will lose the money of that exchange traded note. So, people like exchange traded notes because they often are used to track, you know, things like commodities or a rand dollar exchange rate or something. So it's a little bit harder for privates to go and buy, you know, a whole chunk of gold somewhere. So they like buying the ETN on that. But just remember, you do take the credit risk of the bank that issues those things to you. Better to buy Berkshire Hathaway or an ETN on Berkshire Hathaway? For me, I always prefer to own the physical share as opposed to the ETN. So personally, I guess it is a personal choice. I would rather own my Berkshire Hathaway shares than an ETN on Berkshire Hathaway. Also, because I get the benefit of an invitation to go and listen to Mr. Buffett and his partner Charlie Munger every year in Omaha if I'm a shareholder. Yeah. So I like that deal as well. So I would buy the Berkshire Hathaways is my short answer.
That really is really good sound advice. Warren Ingram, personal financial advisor and executive director at Galileo Capital. Good to chat to you once again on The Money Show. I'm sure I will chat to you again next Thursday.
Thanks so much, Ray. It's great to chat.